welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. Today is February 8th, 2026. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
Well, Willis.
Yes.
What do you have for us today?
Well, I'd like to say we have some good news, but got some.
I know. Yeah, a little bit of a
challenging news today.
A dearth of good news yet again.
Can I throw something in really quick?
Oh, please do.
Oh, yeah. So today is a big cultural event. It's called the Super Bowl.
Stupid Bowl?
Yeah. And so there's these gambling apps you can use to find out, you know, what color the sports drink's going to be when you spill it on the winning coach's head, or how many times, you know, the mascot gets physically assaulted by patrons.
That's just sad.
But I have a tip.
You do?
I do. I can tell you right now, before the game even starts, what the score is going to be.
Okay.
All right.
Do we have to watch the game to know?
No.
Okay, good.
Good tip for your listeners. Get out your paper and pencil. Here's what the score is going to be before the game even starts. 0-0.
0-0.
Before the game starts, is 0-0.
I'm going to put money on that.
Huh. So Kings versus Sharks, 0-0.
Yep. Kings versus the Maple Leafs.
That's my little shtick for the day. Thanks.
I like it.
Yeah.
You'll have to hang through the commercial to learn about the color of the what is it? The color
Bad Bunny's
of
the underwear.
Oh man.
Bill made it dirty.
Yeah.
Made it dirty.
Bill wrecked it.
Yep.
Good God, let's get to Mike. Let's talk about the dire state of the gas crisis on the West Coast. So, just in case you have not been paying attention, I set up a domain. It's called gascrisis.org. Just simple, straightforward, gascrisis.org. It does take you to We the People Radio, but it takes you to a focused page about the gas crisis. Hence the name, right? And I'm putting all of the things that that Mike and Professor Miche and Stan Ellis are putting out. I'm just adding all those to that one page. So it's kind of a one-stop shop. I'm also putting all the interviews there. We have all three of them on next week, but Mike agreed to come on for an hour with us this afternoon just to give us an update specifically on Valero closing down. Because that really was his, field of work. How about that? So he was the, he was in the Navy. Go Navy. Robert, weren't you in the Navy? No, you were Army. Oh, he was in the Air Force. I forgot. God, all I had left was Marines. I was getting closer. I was circling the target. Okay, go all of you. So he used to work, you know, he was a senior refinery technician and whatever, an A complex control board supervisor. I guess A is better than B, huh? Refinery safety committee chairman and the environmental controls unit SME for Exxon Valero and the Benicia refinery. So he was there for quite a while and knows how that works. So I realized in speaking with him the other day, we don't really know a lot about, I mean, we've got the idea of what refineries do, but we don't know all the ins and outs of refineries. So when we talk about refineries closing down, the danger is we think, oh, well, they'll just reopen or something.
No.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. And then I hear Mike in the back of my mind going, no. So we thought maybe today you could give us sort of the nickel tour of what goes on in the refining process, because there's a lot to it. A lot more than just, you hear some oil, now it becomes gas, the end, right?
Yeah. It comes in, miracle occurs here, product's out, now it doesn't.
The miracle of modern technology?
Yeah. The refineries, all the refineries are very complex. The processes are very complex. There's a lot of hazards, dangers, stuff like that involved in refining the crude oil. The key to it was just respecting those dangers, and then, you know, usually they'd make a mistake. But basically the crude oil will come into the refinery. You come from wherever. Crude oil is a mix of all kinds of components, of asphaltenes to carbon to jet to diesel, lighter components like gasoline that are naturally in the crude oil. It all depends on where it comes from. Some refineries will run one straight crude oil from a source. Other refineries, like Benicia, used to run a mix of kind of a balance of different components within the crude oil to optimize the refinery, to optimize its gasoline, jet, and diesel production. So basically, the crude oil is brought either by pipeline or by tanker across the ocean or from Alaska or wherever. It's brought into the refinery. It's heated up. It's cleaned up. You actually got to clean it because, you know, it's coming out of the ground. So there's salts, there's dirt. It actually gets water washed in the process. And then that water goes off to their wastewater treating plant. But the crude oil gets heated up the first part of the process. There's two processes to refining crude oil. The first one is distillation or fractionation. The second is conversion or cracking. So in the first part of it, the crude oil gets heated up, cleaned up, and then it gets put into a huge tower, column or tower, very tall, very wide, in that about 720 degrees. The stuff that is lighter, what is referred to as lighter, which would be like the diesel, the jet fuel, the gasoline, and the butane lighter components, they distill up the tower. It's just one big still. And all different sections of the tower, you're controlling the temperature. To where, you know, you're going up the tower, the diesel will start to condense out and you can draw it off. Then the lighter components go up, which would be the jet fuels next, around tray 12 in that tower. It was drawn off, and then gasoline and lighter goes off the top of the tower, what they call the overhead, and it goes on to other fractionating towers where they separate butane from propane. They separate the gasoline from the butane and propane. So there's like four or five different towers where this separation occurs. What didn't distill up the tower and leave the tower, that first tower drops down to the bottom of the tower. It's pumped out. It's heated up even higher to about 804, 805 degrees. Then it's put into a tower that's under a total vacuum. And what that does for you is it lowers all of the boiling points. So you want to draw off the vacuum gas oils, the light gas oils, the heavy gas oils, and then what comes out of that bottom of that tower, it'll set up an ambient temperature. It's called resid. It's like asphalt. Basically, it's like an asphalt-type component. So what didn't distill out of the tower goes on, and it gets sent to what's called conversion units, where they use different, there's actually three types. There's a fluid catalytic cracking unit, and then what they call typically a hydrocracker. These units run from, I don't know, 20 psi up to 3,000 psi, and anywhere from 500 to as high as 1,200 degrees Fahrenheit.
Wow.
And what you're doing with those components, this is where your big money-making opportunity is, to your ability to take those. When you could take stuff like gear oil component or grease-type components, you know, a lot of hydrocarbons, a lot of carbons in the molecule, they pass those across a catalyst and they break those molecules. And what they're shooting for depends on which refinery you're at and what the industry is around that refinery, like Flying J down in Bakersfield, where Stan's from. That refinery down there was designed to make more diesel and some gasoline. The refinery in Richmond, Chevron, that refinery is designed to make more jet fuel and gasoline. And then Valero, the Benicia refinery, which was Exxon originally, they Exxon SO, Humble Oil, back in 68, 69, then they changed their name to Exxon, I think, a year later. But they saw the vision of what was happening in California with the population increasing, with traffic, you know, more and more cars. I mean, we're talking back in 69, which, you know, we were all around for. So, you know, even back then, we know this. You don't have to be a refining, you know, genius to know this. You can understand this. All of us can. that back then the cars population was increasing, businesses were increasing, California was, you know, strong economy and getting stronger. So Exxon saw the need to build a refinery that could make as much gasoline as possible out of what crude oil it brought in. So Valero per barrel of crude oil feed that comes into it converts more of that to gasoline than any refinery in the state of California. That's why it's shutting down on January 31st. That and its jet fuel and diesel production, that's why it is really, it's not good. We're in a bad situation.
So it's already shut down?
That's correct. It shut down January 31st. A couple days later, the professor said he got reports of thermal imaging and said it was cold. And then the day afterwards, my buddy, who's retired, he's in Mississippi now, but he told me, Mike, the crude unit, cat unit, and coker, they're all completely shut down. That means it's down. And they had to come down for inspections, but more than likely, it's very unlikely they're going to come back up and go till April. If they do, it'll be at very reduced rates because they canceled their crude oil contracts back in October. So since then, they've been drafting their tanks, taking their tanks out of service. So the tanks for like the cat unit, the coker, the hydrocracker, they've been drafting those tanks down to minimum so they can clear them. It's not a turnaround. It's not a maintenance period. They're shutting down. So they're taking these tanks completely out of service. It is more than likely by now that those tanks are at minimum level. And finally, they just ran out of the ability to send anything to the unit to keep them running. So they pulled the plug on it. And again, you know, they were saying until April. They are down now. That's 4.3 to 4.5 million gallons a day of gasoline is offline. It's not coming back. That takes us to 42 to 43% of imports. We are importing 42 to 43% of our gasoline from India, South Korea, and Singapore.
Hmm. So with Valero shutting down, they've already increased those imports, obviously, to make up the difference?
Well, you know, we were kind of thinking they were limited before Valero shuts down. We'll see. I think the state was not designed to bring these imports in. They were designed to bring crude oil in on tankers to the refinery docks or pipe it in from Southern California. They were designed to bring the crude oil in. Our main concern right now, there's two concerns. One is that we're at a limit on what we can bring in from tankers that we can offload and get out to various parts of the state and Reno and Vegas and Phoenix. The other part is, and this is where Governor Newsom is so disingenuous, and I'm trying to be kind here, because, you know, you can have storms where I've actually cut the refinery back because of storms, because crude oil was being held up in Alaska. You can have another refinery. We're down to 7 now, down from 40. We're down to 7. If another refinery goes offline, that will cripple us. They had a problem at the Port of Los Angeles with their cargo ship a month ago that caught fire. The fire was so bad they pulled it out away from the dock. If we have a problem out in the world, we have something develop with Taiwan or some other situation or some other storms or something that impacts the supply, it will very quickly put us into a shortage because we don't have the refineries to recover ourselves out of the shortage. Back in the 70s, when we had our crude oil embargo, once the crude oil came back, we had the ability to refine that crude oil. We had the ability to get the whole country back on its feet and keep going. If any of these scenarios occur, and to think that these things, some of these things won't occur is, in my opinion, is extremely naive. And again, I would call the governor out as disingenuous because he has no control over these things. He cannot predict them. He has no control, yet he looks right at us and says, hey, don't worry about it. We got it handled. It's like, how do you got it handled? If you get a typhoon out there near Singapore, how do you handle that?
Yeah.
You can't. You can't handle these things. You were absolutely disingenuous to your populace.
So as far as the imports go, we were importing the crude oil to be refined here. Now, without the refineries, are we importing the finished product? Or because it doesn't do any good to import the crude oil if there's no place to send it.
Yeah, and that's, you know, Bill, that's the part that I'm puzzled, because the feds, President Trump and his Secretary of Transportation and Duffy, they've taken intervention on the offshore platforms off of Santa Barbara, Hondo, Harmony, and Heritage, which is on the Outer Continental Shelf. They actually took that line, pipeline, going to California and into Kern County, and they re-termed it as interstate, not intrastate. And basically they told California, we're going to start pumping crude oil from here back into the state because they were taking the crude. And back when I ran the refinery, we got crude oil from there. What they've been doing since like 2015 is sending crude oil, our California Outer Continental Shelf crude oil, they've been sending it to South Korea, and then they refine it and bring it to us. So, yes, what's coming in, and this is the danger. This is all our refined product. You know, it's like I saw one write-up where it said, hey, China, please keep bringing us jet fuel while we're defending Taiwan against you.
Yeah, what could go wrong?
What could go wrong? And right. A lot of our fuel comes in on Chinese Costco tankers.
Dang. Well, let's let that sink in for 5 seconds and take a quick break here. We're going to come back with our guest, Mike Ariza. You can find all the information on this specific issue at gascrisis.org. But you are listening to We the People Radio. We'll be right back.
We are the best shuffling crew, shuffling on down, doing it for you. We're so bad, we know we're good, blowing your mind like a new year's would. You know we're just strutting for fun, strutting our stuff on everyone. We're not here to start no trouble, we're just here to do the Super Bowl shuffle.
There you go, Mike.
You never disappoint.
Tell us more about the weird science at the refinery. Since I just exhausted my knowledge with what I learned from the song.
Oh.
So basically what we're looking at now is more and more refined product being shipped over from Korea and points beyond, rather than the actual crude oil coming in.
Yeah, and that's the thing. If we'll go back to the crude oil real quick, but if you look at the history, I've been on a couple of different things, and you know, down to LA Radio on Thursday. People don't understand. They don't understand that this started back in the 80s, but it really took off in 2023 when they converted Rodeo ConocoPhillips and they converted Marathon Martinez to renewable diesel. They took those two refineries off 360,000 barrels a day of crude oil production. Okay, well, if you're just doing renewable diesel, you don't make the gasoline, you don't make the jet fuel, you don't make the propane, which is a big one up north where we're at. You don't make any of those components. So back in 2023, we started importing somewhere around 18 to 20% of our gasoline at that point. You know, same thing with jet fuel, and then, you know, propane was just offline. Then, fast forward to October of 2025, we know about the egregious regulations, the fines that these refineries are going to get slammed with. You know, when they made this tank farm announcement where the refineries had to hold up more gasoline and then look, you were looking at making them build more storage tanks. It was like a few days later, Phillips 66 said, okay, with everything and this, we're done. Okay. So they went down in October. They just shut down. That was another 9% of our gasoline, 9, 10, 8, you know, depending on what they're doing that day. But basically we went from around 20% importing in October to 30% importing. And then Valero also, not too long after the announcement from Phillips 66, they announced that they were going to shut down. That took another 12 percent of the state's gasoline production offline. So we're well over now importing 40% of it. And the thing is that the state has been, like the CEO of Chevron says, you know, was quoted, it says they the state has been at war with the refineries for 25 years. Case in point, Valero took a $1.1 billion with a B dollar loss to shut the refinery down and get out of California.
Yeah, that tells you a lot, doesn't it?
They're willing,
willing to take that kind of a loss just to get out.
Well, the thing is, they don't, Chevron, you know, everybody, a lot of folks know that after 140 years of being headquartered in California, they moved to Houston. Their refineries, I'm pretty convinced they're still running because they own their own crude oil. Okay, when Exxon owned the Benicia refinery when I was there running it, they own their own crude oil. So they would sell crude oil to the you know, you got the upstream, the midstream. The upstream is the crude oil production. The midstream is the refinery. Downstream is everything after that, the consumers and all that. See, the upstream, they were making a lot of money selling the crude oil to their own refinery. And even if the refinery back then, the margins were not good, and maybe they were even taking a little bit of a loss, Exxon would just write off the loss. And it's because they were making a whole lot of money, you know, selling their own crude oil to the refinery. Well, Chevron owns their own crude oil. Valero does not. Phillips 66 does not. They don't own their crude oil. And the losses that the refineries are taking, they're not the little minor losses they were taking back in the day. They're huge losses, and then they're getting set with huge fines. Valero spent $600 or $700 million building an MEA unit, a wet gas scrubber, a steam generator, and two brand new furnaces for the crude unit to get the remaining the SO2 sulfur dioxide and particulate slippage that was going out the main stack and had been doing it for 40 years. They invested all that money, and then here they are getting slapped with the largest fine in the history of the state for their hydrogen generation unit, which every refinery has hydrogen generation units, you know, multiple hydrogen generation units in most cases. It's the cleanest unit in the refinery. They make hydrogen and carbon dioxide. Then they get slapped an $82 million fine, and the kicker on that was the Barrier Air Quality Management District changed the way in which the fine was distributed. So suddenly now the offended or hurt community gets like half of the fine, and then they quote on their report that, you know, Valero is releasing carcinogens, reproductive harm agents, and they've been doing this for 20 years. And I'll throw it back at them and say, no, they've been running this unit for 56 years. And there have been no elevated cases of cancer, reproductive harm agents in the city of Benicia. It's actually a very clean, healthy place to live. Same thing with the industrial park around the refinery and the workers within the refinery. There are no elevated cases of anything. And then the city gets, I don't know, $30, $40 million of the fine, and the mayor of Benicia is on the air board.
Isn't that handy?
Shot himself in the foot.
Well, they did because the refinery had an excellent relationship, especially Exxon and Valero. You know, it's like they would take their firefighters to Texas A&M or Reno back when they had the fire school. They would take them to training. They helped them buy some of the nicest equipment, you know, anywhere in the Bay Area. You know, they had a good partnership with the city. Now their cash cow is gone. They may, whether they got that money or not, that's it. After that, it's done. It's like 15-20% of Benicia's budget was the refinery, you know, the money they got every year. And it's gone, and nobody's going to come buy the refinery. That's the thing. Nobody's going to buy it.
I wonder how they're planning on making up that shortfall. That's a lot.
I have no idea. I mean, Budweiser's shutting down in the same county. Solano County lost the refinery, and they're losing the Budweiser plant in Fairfield that was built in the mid-70s. It's shutting down.
Yeah.
So what does that take with it? I mean, we had, and I keep meaning to go look it up again, we had 41 refineries?
Yeah, something like that in the 80s. It takes us down to basically down to 7. And even though, you know, Valero says they're going to keep their Wilmington refinery open, I know for a fact that they wrote off basically all the losses. They wrote off their Wilmington refinery, so I wouldn't be surprised to see them announce sometime in the middle to the end of the year that it's coming down. That'll take us down to six.
Well, it just makes sense. I mean, I don't care what kind of business you're in. If you're taking a loss every year, you got to do something different. You can't continue to do that.
Yeah, Bill, you have a fiduciary responsibility to your shareholders.
Sure. Absolutely.
And it's not a loss because there's no demand. It isn't that kind of loss.
The demand has barely dropped. The CEC was not even close on their estimate of how many electric cars are going to be running around. They're still consuming somewhere around 36 million gallons of gasoline a day.
Yeah.
And then under the CEC, you look at it, they project jet fuel consumption is going to go up something like 10 or 15% in the next 5 or 7 or 8 years.
And that's the California Energy Commission, just for those people who don't speak acronym. So how do they, I mean, I hate even asking this question, but what are they basing that on? What's the calculation when they talk about it? Oh, we're going to do that because?
Yeah, well, the jet fuel, they're just anticipating into industry growth and, you know, I guess airports and whatnot, stuff like that. The thing that when we were talking about at the break, when we were talking about the crude oil pipeline, mm-hmm. and it being reclassified as interstate, and then there's another state bill, 1137, I think it is. But anyway, there's another state bill where homes and schools can't be within, it's over half a mile, it's like 3,200 feet of one of those pump jacks. So right now, I think it was maybe the Pambani and them, they're fighting that now because that takes 15 to 20% of the gas, the crude oil production offline. Also, we know the president, we've heard he's going to intercede on the Palisades. What we need now, and this, you know, we presented this report going on 4 months ago now. The problem, the potential, okay, the potential of the situation we're in with the refineries is, if you look at immigration, illegal immigration, and paying for everybody's medical, and the Palisades, and the train to nowhere, this has the potential to be a bigger hit to California than all those things put together. Mm-hmm. If we see real shortages, which will be across our state and Phoenix and Reno and Las Vegas, again, it's not like the 70s. I've heard people say, well, you know, we had gas lines in the 70s. Well, that's true, but it's not the same. They had the refineries. There's no pipelines coming into our state. It all has to be imported from overseas. So, you know, to sit there and think, something's not going to happen. I mean, Chevron had a big fire 2 months ago down in El Segundo, totally knocked them offline. Their jet production knocked their gasoline units offline for probably like a week. So that's the situation we're in. If people do anything, get your congressman and say, "Hey, President Trump, intervene. We need to take federal EPA, take the California Air Resource Board and the California Energy Commission." And these other agencies, and tell them you no longer, just like they said with the pipeline down south pumping the crude oil into California, you no longer have jurisdiction over this. You're done. Now they're on federal EPA guidelines, which the rest of the country's on, and the rest of the country is doing quite well, and they have clean air and fantastic prices and no problem with supply. That's where we're at now.
The thing that I posted at gascrisis.org was the latest deal you sent me. Average LA and Orange County prices rise for the ninth consecutive day, and that was 2 days ago. And if you click on that, it'll take you to the article, but that's just the beginning. So it's like, well, I think it's at 1.9, there's a 1.9, I'll look it up here. Anyway, so it's already starting. Yeah, 1.9 cents on Thursday.
Valero's a big gasoline maker. That's the thing. They're per barrel of oil, crude oil, they convert it, those conversion units, cracking units, they convert more of their feed to gasoline than anybody else in the state. But that's the way they were designed to run, because that's the way Exxon built it back in 1969. Mm-hmm. They saw that coming, was the need for gasoline, and now it's going the other way.
Well, and just with that little bit of change, here they've kind of quantified all this. The average price has risen 12.9 cents over the past 9 days, including 1.9 cents on Thursday, according to figures from the AAA and Oil Price Information Service. It's 10 cents more than a week ago. So it's like as the rest of the country starts to see major decreases in their gas prices, we're not going to see that.
Well, no, the price, the relatively, I'll say relatively, low prices that we've had compared to prices we've seen before because of the fact that crude oil prices are down and we're in the winter blend. But that's all about the shift. Crude oil prices, I don't anticipate them changing, but we're going to go out of our winter blend. Also, both PBF refineries that are online, the one in Martinez, the one down south, they're going into a shutdown for maintenance called a turnaround for 45 or 50 days. So one PBF refinery is going offline here pretty soon for first quarter, and then another one's going offline in the second quarter. And we are switching to the summer blend, which reduces our total gasoline pool by about 5 or 6% our available supply. That's why the prices go up typically with the summer blend. When we go into the summer with everything running the normal, prices still go up because the supply of gasoline drops off from the summer blend. So we lost Valero. We're going to have two refineries go into a maintenance shutdown, and we're going to go into the summer blend. So it's very possible we'll see gas prices in north of $8 a gallon. And this is assuming nothing happens. You know, I don't want to keep repeating myself, but, you know, another refinery goes down. You know, something happens out there. A theater kind of opens up somewhere out there in the world, starts affecting our supply. There are many things that can occur that can take that to $9, $10, $12 a gallon. Right now we're looking at maybe $8.43, I think was the calculation the professor made. I see that happening, and like you said, it's already starting to walk up.
Do we have the ability, you know, we talk about importing the finished product from overseas in big tankers. Do we have the ability to make up the difference in tankers rather than refining it?
We don't. If it comes from the like the Gulf Coast, that has to be in a Jones Act tanker, and all those tankers that they're American made and American staffed, and those tankers are all spoken for. So we don't really have that flexibility. We definitely don't have the pipelines. The only pipeline coming in anywhere is from El Paso into Tucson. Phoenix doesn't have its own pipeline. Reno and Vegas, they're in trouble. They're really in trouble. They're at the end of our pipelines. They're totally dependent on us. There was some talk about maybe running a pipeline from Utah to Nevada. And if they did that, you're talking 3 or 4 years down the road. And those refineries they're small refineries. They don't have the capacity to produce the fuel for Reno and Vegas right now. So Reno, I mean, we're a fuels island, and Nevada is right there with us. They're totally, both states are totally dependent on these fuel imports, which, again, we did not have the infrastructure to continue to bring them in. We don't have the ability to offload that many fuels tankers. That's a big part of the problem, too. We're at the edge as far as what we can bring in.
And if we brought it here, you still have to, you know, put it somewhere and refine it and move it. And got to take a really quick break. We're going to come back with our guest, Mike Ariza. And we have posted all sorts of interviews. You can read the document he has referenced. It is on the page at gascrisis.org. You can read it right there. You don't even have to download it. But it was released October 21st, 2025, written with Mike Ariza and Professor Michael Miche from USC, and Stan Ellis, who is a member of the California Assembly and an oil and gas man out of the Central Valley, the land man. So there you have it. Get educated. If you don't want to read the 10-pager, read the two-pager, the point of no return that Mike wrote. Send that to somebody, and if it still doesn't interest them, you should just move on. Your friend isn't Your friend is low IQ. How else could I say it? So I have a couple of possible fixes for us in our musical selections for this break, and we'll be right back. You are listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Your size, just when I think I'm gonna get away.
Would you like to ride in my beautiful balloon? Would you like to ride in my beautiful balloon?
We could float among the stars together, you and I.
For we can fly.
We can fly.
Up and away, my beautiful,
And there you have it. Two possible solutions. We will travel everywhere by balloon, or magic will save us.
Yeah. Abracadabra.
Abracadabra. Yep, right? Dear God. And that leftover from the Chinese spy balloon show we did, I was like, oh, yeah, still got the balloon song. Oh, Lord. So after running the refinery for 13 years down there, you had listed for me when we were chatting on the phone the other day all the different things that come out of the refinery, because I think somehow we kind of think, you know, okay, oil comes in, like gas comes out, and that's kind of it. But there's a lot more that is produced there that we use all the time that will now be not produced.
Yeah, do they produce like paint thinner and you know, stuff, you know, creosote, no, you know, there's so many products. Do they produce that there, or does that go off-site and get produced somewhere else?
They don't produce that there. Those will be refineries with specialties like polypropylene and like Richmond. Chevron Richmond has the Richmond Luol project in the refinery where they make their Chevron oils and greases and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Valero did purchased the asphalt plant that is there by the refinery. That was originally was not there. So they make asphalt. The major refineries they make propane, propane, gasoline jet, and diesel. And they'll vary a little bit. It's like Flying J didn't make jet fuel, and they didn't have a cat cracker, so they made feed or oil that was prepared for a cat cracker, and they would sell it. You know, the cat cracker is a big gasoline conversion unit. So it all depends on where they're at and what they're doing. The refineries that I ran just made the major components that we know about.
Hmm.
So, yeah, there's like 6,000, 5,000 products made for crude oil. Asphalt's a big one. I mean, Valero's down, so that asphalt plant's down.
Wow. So our roads aren't going to get any better for a while? Because, you know, they're doing such a great job anyway, but now they'll be a little short on asphalt.
It's been fantastic. So that's propane, it's gas, like actual, you know, car gas, diesel.
Mm-hmm. And jet fuel.
So the jet fuel, what's going to make up the jet fuel loss that comes out of there?
They have to bring it, they have to refine it, and they have to bring it from somewhere overseas.
So overseas is going to supply our jet fuel for our military defense on the West Coast.
So it'll be tankers full of jet fuel coming across the ocean.
That's correct. And diesel, and a bunch of gasoline. That's where it's getting. That's where we're really, our state was not designed to do this.
No.
And again, when you look at all the possibilities that can affect those tankers getting here, the fuel supply, you know, I mean, like, you know, a little while back when my wife was visiting her family, a typhoon went through Hong Kong and Guangzhou, shut down shipping in the whole area for a few days, took their high-speed rail offline for a couple of days. You know, these things, if one goes through and takes a refinery that's supplying us offline, that's making our fuel, if one of our own remaining refineries goes offline from a power failure or a fire like Chevron did, again, this is where Governor Newsom is totally disingenuous. He cannot predict all these different events that could affect our supply.
No, and you know it's going to happen. It always does. I mean, there's...
Well, it's not... Yeah, Bill, it's not... I mean, just common sense.
Yeah.
Just common sense. You don't have to dig or develop some equation to figure this stuff out. It's you know, this stuff, a lot of it within the last 8 weeks to 10 weeks has occurred. Chevron went down from a fire. A tanker was hijacked in the Indian Ocean, a fuels tanker that was bound for a Singapore refinery. You know, you got a typhoon typhoons get generated in that part of the world all the time. We know, you know, there's all kinds of hotbeds going on. You got Iran going on right now. You had a cargo ship that caught fire, and the fire was so bad they pulled it away from the port of Los Angeles to make sure it didn't damage the port. I mean, if something happens to the port of Los Angeles, we are.
Oh, yeah. We're in big trouble.
Yeah, and the thing is, we can't, again, I've said this, but, you know, we can't pull out of it. We don't have the refineries like we did back in the 70s to get things back to normal. We just don't have them. They're not available. So we get into a deep shortage, and that's where, when we were writing our report, you know, military is big-time compromised, especially, you know, you got Valero making most of Travis's jet fuel. And right now they're burning 190,000 gallons a day, but that's peacetime. There's nothing going on. You start sending sorties, they could punch well over a million gallons a day of fuel. We could end up possibly with our because you got a C-5 and a KC-10 fuel extender. They almost use 100,000 gallons themselves, just those two planes. You know, we could end up with our military. We could end up with our military based in the Midwest.
Mm. Well, you know, we had a hard time figuring out how to keep water in the reservoirs down south to fight fires. I have full confidence that they're going to have this figured out for any kind of emergency contingency plan.
Well, and there we had talked about this at one point. I don't remember which time, but there's kind of a misnomer that the storage facilities, like at Valero, could be redeployed to store oil, gas, whatever kind of product, but that's not really workable, correct?
It's not workable like they're thinking it is, and right now Valero, due to their vapor recovery system, Valero is not capable of offloading gasoline at their dock. They can bring in jet, they can bring in diesel, but they cannot receive gasoline at this point.
And why is that? Isn't it kind of the same equipment?
It's the same equipment, but there's special requirements because of gasoline and the vapor pressure, and that equipment's not, that equipment's offline.
Mm.
So they'd have to put in some investment, put in some money, which I think I'd have a hard time seeing them doing that, but, you know.
Yeah, right.
Well, yeah, and after these guys got fined into oblivion for, what exactly was the $1.1 billion, what's the nickel tour on what that involved?
Well, it's just the investments of the enemy capital they've had to put in there. You know,
are we talking like Air Resources Board, you know, mumbo jumbo fines? I mean, is that kind of at the base of this? Is regulatory?
Well, it's fine. It's regulations. It's carbon trap, cap and trade, all these different.
Of course. How could I have forgotten that?
You got all these different fines and fees and taxes that are put on the refinery. Well, again, Valero doesn't own their crude oil, so you know if they're paying rent prices for the crude, then what they're getting out, you know, they're selling it for relatively cheap. A lot of the reason why our prices are so high is for all these other reasons, all these other fees and taxes and regulations that are added on to the gasoline. They're not making that money. So what they're actually making at the end, you know, with the product that they're making, that's where they, that's part of the reason why, part of the reason why they lose money.
Sure.
The margins aren't there. You want to get specific, you know, more specifics, the professor next weekend can definitely address some of those specific questions, but that's a lot of it. They're just, what they sell it for, what it's being sold for to us is not the refinery making that money. They're making, I don't know, $1.50, $1.80 a gallon less. It goes all to the state. So when you're looking at, you're buying the crude oil, you're doing maintenance. A refinery maintenance period can cost $300-$400, $500 million just to do the maintenance that they have to do every 3 to 4 years. You know, shut down and what they got to do. So it's all those things factor into the bottom line, and that's where all their losses have come from.
Yeah. Makes sense. And all the people, like, so when you spoke with some of the folks that you had worked with in the past, they are relocating, retiring, all of the above?
All of the above. And, I mean, you think about it, Aaron, Bill, you know, if you're 45 or so, pick a number, you know, a little younger than us, you get a chance to go to Louisiana, or you get a chance to go to Texas, make the same amount of money or make more, but you leave California, you know, hey, we'll offer you a transfer. I'm gone.
yeah, your tax burden goes way down. Your
cost of living,
you know.
Everything, yeah. You know, you have the highest electricity costs here, you know, housing costs, taxes, you know, the whole nine yards. So, yeah, no, it's like buy California. But, you know, we got folks that, you know, I'm 60. I would just retired. I would have said, okay, hey, thank you, I'm done. You know, if they offered me some transfer, I might have taken it and worked a few more years. But a lot of these folks they're retired, they're transferring, and you're not going to get them back.
No.
Some are just quitting, you know, going to different jobs. But bottom line is your skilled workforce in these different refineries goes away, and you need that skilled workforce to restart the refinery. That's the biggest problem. That's another one of the dangers is, once the qualified people are gone, they are near impossible to restart. And especially Valero, there's few people on the planet that are qualified to run it. And even those have a lot of people that have a lot of experience, they don't have experience with that plant. So they got to get up to speed on that plant, and they show up and it's stone cold and it's not even running. So there's a lot of this many, many, many issues to trying to get them restarted.
Well, and out here in the West, we've seen a similar power slide with timber, with the timber industry. And so as the mills have closed and closed and closed, nobody's coming rolling in going, well, let's just start them all up again. Once an industry is crushed like that, there isn't a huge appetite for people to spend the type of money it takes to get that moving again.
No, and you're stuck buying products that have to be imported, which costs
a huge
way more money.
Even if the administration, this administration, comes in and makes some changes, I've never, you know, I've put gas in the car, and there ends my my association. but even I know that that's a terrible investment, because in a couple of years, the next phase of the operation could roll in and, you know, crush them again.
And it always has been. You know, it always has been. We show up, we put the gas in the tank. You know, we never would have expected. You know, now we're advocating our price control, our supply control to foreign countries. And, you know, the foreign countries that may or may not remain friendly to us. We don't know the situation the world could develop and affect those countries. We've advocated our price control. We're paying whatever, you know, it's like India was buying Russian oil. So we were basically supporting Ukraine, or supporting Putin in the Ukrainian war. Apparently India is going to switch now, but then the crude oil that they're going to get is going to cost them more. So that is going to be reflected in the price of the finished products they're sending to us. Mm-hmm. You got to pay the shipping costs, you know, all these costs on top of it, you know, just stack on up. And then you still got to pay cap and trade and all these other taxes that come along with California, even though the fuel's made 7,000-8,000 miles away. all those things just add up, and it's just going to get more and more expensive, and the supply is going to get shorter. And when you get down to about a 11 or 12 day supply of gasoline available in California, the price jumps a buck and a half.
Yeah,
a gallon.
The world changes.
Yes,
Mr. Ariza, we have run out of time. You have indeed blinded us with science, and we appreciate that. And we will chat with you next week for a longer stint with Stan Ellis and Professor Miche. Thank you so much. Happy Super Bowl Sunday for what that's worth. And we're going to be right back talking about election integrity. And you can find all of this information at gascrisis.org. Second hour of We the People Radio. Today is February the 8th, 2026. And we were discussing the gas crisis the first hour. You can find all that information on our website, but we have given you a direct link on that topic at gascrisis.org. We hope you will share that with other people. There's a lot of information you can read, you can watch, you can listen, and you can do all three. But we have given you no shortage of info there. This hour, we're going to switch gears, and we are chatting with the Election Integrity Project in California. So we have Ruth Weiss and we have Linda Payne, and I do not have bios for either of them, so they can tell us as much or as little as they would like. But holy cow, Linda, we talked to her right after she invented the election integrity process. I can't remember if Ruth, if you were there at the beginning or not.
Almost.
Almost at the beginning?
A couple months later, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And so, I don't know, this is like, good grief, like 14 years ago or something.
Well, this is our 16th year.
Well, there you go. We discovered you way back when in our world. And it's just become more and more and more important. So you guys are a California nonprofit, public benefit corporation committed to defending through education, research, and advocacy the civil rights of U.S. citizens to fully participate in the election process under federal and state law. And I guess your own website is the most succinct. It's eip-ca.com. So eip-ca.com.
If I can clarify, Aaron,
yes.
The acronym doesn't have the hyphen.
Oh, it doesn't?
The email address does. No, because we couldn't get EIPCA,
yeah.
Uppercase EIPCA, with the domain itself in order to use it for an email address and a website address. So we were forced to put a hyphen between EIP and CA.
Uh-huh.
But everyone knows this by most, but the correct acronym doesn't have that.
Yeah. So, but if they put eipca.com, it doesn't go to the right spot. You got to have the hyphen in there.
Correct.
Yeah. No sweat. Well, we have you on the page for today, so they can link through that if they're driving around or whatever and don't have a pen in their hand. But you guys want to give us a little bit of background on this, or jump right into? Yeah, you drive the bus. We'll follow along. How about that?
Okay. Yep. So you captured so much of the history of who we are, so, and I appreciate that. But yeah, we started after the 2010 election and realized there were issues. And without the long story of that, we started our first research of voter rolls in 2011 and our first observation of the election process in 20 counties in 2012. And so we've grown from there. But the most important thing that has happened over the 15 years of research. And all of our research is original source and eyewitness testimony. And we've tried many, many efforts to get action taken about what we really will say is a corrupt system, impenetrable. in multiple ways than entry points. But last year, the most important thing we did were two things. One was to propose to Congress comprehensive federal election integrity legislation, and Ruth is going to talk about that and using the amazing articles that she's been writing. She's an amazing author. I get to poke at it and edit, but she's just really the author of most of these. And then after she finishes, I'd like to talk about the voter roll research that we have on our website, 2020 and 2024 research of the 2022. This is where seats are flipped. So that's how, if we can do it, that's how we'd like to be able to give people a lot of good information in a nutshell.
Very good. So
Ruth, why don't you
hit it, Ruth?
I'll do that then. In our proposal, I think there are about 17 different suggestions that are proposals that we made. I've kind of combined a few of them together so that it turns out in the article to be about 11, but in the proposal, a few of them are separated out and described independently. But the first article in the series that we have going now, which is called Understanding EIPCA's Federal Legislative Proposal, in the very first article, which all of these can be found on our website as soon as they've been published. And so part one has been published, and this is giving the basic history of why we're asking what we are asking here of Congress. And we go through the idea that we tried to do everything all the right way for the first 12 or 13 or 14 years, by working locally and working with elections divisions in the counties and at the state, and then working with the legislature, and then finally going through courts with a few lawsuits. And we just discovered that there was absolutely no way that we could solve any of these issues internally within California. In the meantime, during that 15 years, a lot of the very bad ideas that California implemented have migrated into a lot of other states, and therefore this becomes a national election integrity critical situation here. You know, it's an emergency, which is why we're asking now Congress to do this, because it's not just for the benefit of the state of California, but actually the entire nation, if we want to retain this republic and allow the people to accurately select the people who are going to govern them. So briefly, the elements in our proposal, there are two elements in the law that everybody's hearing a lot about these days before Congress, called the SAVE Act, and that requires citizenship proof when you register to vote and photo voter ID when you're going to cast a ballot. And so we really support that law, but it falls far short of plugging all the holes that Linda referenced in our system. So there's a new law the committee to whom we presented our proposal has now authored a new law called Make Elections Great Again, MEGA, MEGA, and it contains a much larger number of our proposals. So the ones I'm going to go through now are what we're proposing, and then if people are listening and going, well, why would we need that, or, you know, whatever, as you read through these articles, we're taking these one at a time and explaining more in depth the necessity for these actions to be taken. But besides the registering with proof of identity and citizenship, we want to eliminate vote by mail, except for the people who absolutely can demonstrate an actual need. In other words, get rid of just sending ballots to everybody indiscriminately, and just make sure that people who need an absentee ballot apply for one each time that they need it.
Like we used to in the olden days.
Yes, and it's been the case in some states, and it was true in California until 1998, and then it got, you know, kind of mixed up. And now, of course, as of 2020, California is a universal vote-by-mail, and that's a tremendous destroyer of election integrity. And we could go into all the history with the presidential commissions and everything on that. But so we want to limit voting by mail. We're asking Congress to stop ballot harvesting, which, of course, wouldn't be much of a thing if not everybody had a vote by mail ballot, right? But we want to limit ballot harvesting back to the original, which is only the voter or a family member or caretaker can turn in the ballot if that voter is not able to do so. We also want to get rid of undocumented chains of custody, That's the biggest problem with vote by mail ballots is you have no chain of custody. And so we want to get rid of community drop boxes and that sort of thing as well, because the chain of custody disappears the minute you put your ballot into those boxes. We also are asking that same-day registration be eliminated, because it is an enormous way for people to register to vote and get that vote counted without going through all of the checks and balances that we have before we put someone on the voter rolls. And we have pretty good reason to believe that a large number of ballots that are being cast without a voter to match up to winds up with that system of just walking in and voting on the day that you register. We also believe that Congress should demand reasonable deadlines for registration rather than, you know, too close to Election Day. We need to have adequate time and opportunity to audit the registrations and double-check the eligibility of these people. We're asking that Election Day, whatever Election Day is, currently it's on that Tuesday, but, you know, Congress wants to change it, fine. But whatever is named Election Day, be the day on which all ballots have to be in the hands of the elections officials by 8 p.m. that night at the close of the polls. So no more late ballots. We have states that allow ballots to come in up to 17 or 21 days after Election Day and be counted. California's deadline is now 7 days, but any late ballot, there's no excuse for it, and so we're asking them to eliminate being able to vote after the fact.
Is that including, like, postmark, somebody puts it in the mail type of thing?
No, it's not. We want to say no. It's got to be in the hands of the elections officials. It can't be on its way because it has a postmark. And the Postal Service has made the postmark a real difficult situation recently by changing their rules, and they're warning people, we cannot guarantee that the day you put the ballot in our hands is the day that the postmark will reflect.
Right.
And so it's going to be a real gray area at this point anyway. So we just want to eliminate that. Say, come on, if you can't turn your ballot in on time, then, you know, you've got, what, 30 days to do it, or 45 if you're overseas. So there's certainly no reason to accept a ballot coming in late. We also have talked about the National Voter Registration Act and the Help America Vote Act as having really holes in them. NVRA, the National Voter Registration Act, is one that actually has contradictions within itself, so that no election official can actually follow that law, because if you follow one thing, then you're violating another thing. And so they need to clean that up or just get rid of it and replace it with something a lot more simple. It was originally designed to make a registration more accessible so that more people could get on the voter rolls without a lot of hassle. And we support that. But it has been abused now by California and a large number of states. Instead of making these registration forms available at all these places that people frequent, California is now mandated registration. You know, you walk in, they automatically send your stuff and register you, and that is not part of a free society. And it also allows for a lot of people who may be ineligible to have their information sent up to the Secretary of State and get through onto the voter roll. So that's not a good thing. And the Help America Vote Act had a lot of good things to help clean the voter rolls, to help keep registration available to everyone, so that nobody was denied the ability to register. But there's just too many holes in it, and both of those acts have been highly abused. California's biggest abuse, in my opinion, is the use of the provisional ballot way outside the bounds of what the HAVA Act actually suggested. So we're asking them to really rework both of those laws and create a federal database for states to be able to use, so that they can accurately determine whether they've got voters who are voting in more than one state, and make sure that their voter rolls stay clean. We want to ask Congress to prohibit the mandatory or automatic registration of people when they interact with the DMV or other federal and state agencies because of the errors that have happened there, particularly getting non-citizens registered to vote. And then those registrations become a great pile of registrations that the registrant himself is not even aware is there. And so they become ripe for abuse. We're asking that the federal registration form that is part of these laws be changed, because it does not ask for proof of citizenship. And so all this, any state that wanted to ask for proof of citizenship, they were denied that ability, because in this law, the federal registration form, which this, all states have to accept, doesn't have that on it. So we're asking that they put that on the federal registration
because
form.
Because right
well,
now it so just says, are you a citizen, yes or no, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And there's no research in that.
Correct.
If you check yes, you're a citizen. And if you check no, you're not a citizen. And if you don't check either one, the default is, okay, he's a citizen. So that's not okay.
Did not know that.
Yeah, it is. And in fact, some states, I think California is one of them, if you check no, they actually send you a card back and say, now, are you sure you checked this box? Are you sure you don't want to change your mind? So it's just a little bit.
Would you like to change your answer?
Exactly. That's your final answer.
Yeah, you're right. There you go. So, that's it.
Yeah.
Holy cow.
And then the amount of time that was set up by these laws to get a person who has become inactive off the voter rolls is really outrageous. It takes, from the moment a voter just simply ceases to communicate electorally at all, they don't vote, they don't sign petitions, they don't update anything, nobody hears from them. It takes 8 years to get them off the voter rolls. In the entire time that they're waiting, those 8 years, to make sure that person really isn't active anymore, it causes those registrations to be vulnerable to impersonation.
Yeah, shoot. Well, that's only two presidential elections, so.
Exactly.
You know,
right.
How big a deal could that be? Oh, my God.
Exactly.
Ladies,
so,
we have to take a really quick break, and then we're going to come back and do some more scary math with you. We are chatting with Linda and Ruth from the Election Integrity Project. Their website is eip-ca.com, and you can find that all at wethepeopleradio.us.
I've done the math, calibrated the imperfections. I got my slide rule from school. You add it up, and it don't add up. Maybe shed some light on it too. And I'm just inches close to the finish. Cross it and bid you adieu. I calculated every combination, every misdirection, every subtle deception. Kickstart my thinking, I was lost in space, staring at a spot on the moon. Negotiating the anticipation of reentering the atmosphere too soon.
Possible theme song for your musical. Why are we doing it this way? Okay. So now where?
Well, you want me to just run through the last of them really, really quickly?
No worries.
We're asking that anything that is structurally anti-democratic or confusing or unreliable be prohibited, such as the top two primary or the jungle primary and the ranked choice voting and the registration of people under the age of 18. We want to have an alignment of requirements for out-of-country voters to match the security level of the in-country voters, because we found a lot of difficulty with that particular system in the last couple of elections. We want to limit the number of days for early voting and prohibit, this is the big one, prohibit election technology So we want to get rid of electronic poll books, voting machines, ballot marking devices, because all of them are vulnerable, every single one of them. And day after day after day, we're getting more and more evidence that not only are they vulnerable, but those vulnerabilities are being accessed. And we cannot be have any sense that we have a secure election. So we want to go back to in-person voting with paper ballots that are watermarked and secured and hand-counted at the precinct level. You have states like California that that take 30 days to let us know who won, and you can do with hand counting at the precinct level. You can do it within a day or a day and a half. So we deserve to have the results of our elections a lot sooner than a month later, and we should be able to do that by making that big change. And so that basically summarizes all of the major asks in our proposal. And so, you know, it's a lot to chew on, and that's why we've broken it down into a series of articles so that people could chew on each one of those one at a time. So we encourage people to go to our website, download those articles, sign up to get them into your own box, because we're on, I think we're on number 4 now coming up. So we've got 3 you can go in and read, and then just get the rest of them on a weekly basis as we put them out.
Well,
thank you, Ruth.
I think that's a good place to start.
That, and we need, before we go into the voter rolls, it's really critical that we get the word out to the whole country. And so, Aaron, we really appreciate you having us on your radio show. So many people have no idea that Californians have the best documented evidence, so our attorneys tell us, of depth and breadth and through the length of time, as you've noticed. So we're not recommending these changes because we have a feeling there's something wrong. It's because we've documented the problem. And one of the biggest issues that we've also documented is the voter rolls, and that's also on our website. We've got a little box up there where we put series of articles or links to research, and one is called EIPCA Voter Roll Research Results for 2020, and 2022, and we include live links to our research. We are working this year to get in front of Attorney General Pam Bondi and Kristi Noem, Department of Homeland Security, and that's because in those two sets of research of the statewide voter rolls, we identified critical issues that made it possible to flip the seats in 2020 and 2022 in California. And it's our opinion that it appears that potentially criminal action has taken place. So if anyone would like to see what kind of work we do in the voter rolls, which, of course, everyone does across the country, which is good. But in 2022, if you go to that little box and click on the research for 2022, you'll see that we did the research of the voter rolls all through 2020. We sent 16 letters to the Department, Secretary of State, and registrars of voters, alerting them to critical issues that we were finding in the voter rolls and encouraging them not to send out these massive vote-by-mail ballots because they were going to send them to almost 500,000 ineligible names on the voter rolls. They ignored it, and so in 2021, we put a letter to Attorney General Padilla, not Attorney General, Secretary of State Padilla at the time, letting him know what we found. And one of the biggest concerns I have in that research is a live link to one of the questions regarding the thousands of people on the voter rolls that show their place of birth is from another country. So in our research, we show in 2017, here are the names, it's 14 pages long, the names of all the people on the voter rolls that show place of birth as a foreign country. But then in 2020, miraculously, thousands of them changed their place of birth to California or the United States.
Wow.
And so that's a little criminality there, in our opinion, and we need the Department of Justice to look at that. So that's why we have it out there. We've had it out there since 2021, and we've sent many people and journalists across the country to look at that. And as journalists ask the question, what happened there? We have another one there in 2024. Our data research team, they are amazing and very talented. And our chief analyst, Ellen Swenson, has done so much of this work. She's brilliant. But in 2024, our team asked if they could order the exact snapshot of the 2022 voter rolls. data that the Secretary, California Secretary of State Weber, sent to Congress saying, here are the federal seats that were voted for by the citizens of California. And so we went ahead and ordered that data. Normally we get the data in a week. It took them 4 months. We finally got that exact snapshot of the certified data, and you'll see in a link to the certification that she sent. And when our team ran that data, we found that after certification, 43,000 plus extra ballots were added to the numbers that were sent to Congress.
Wow.
And if you recall, in 2022, there were seats that were flipped. Many of them were tied to L.A. County or they were in L.A. County. We have a live link to one of our reports that we sent called Method of Voting. And in the research of the voter rolls, we identify the people with each voter ID number given to them by VoteCal that shows if they voted by mail, if they voted in person, or if they voted same day. And if you go to that link, you'll see every county is listed, but especially go to L.A. County, and you will see thousands that were switched. Some voted twice, not switched, but, well, I think they're switched. The big question is what happened with them. Here's the same voter ID number, voted in person at a vote center and voted by mail, or voted twice by mail, or voted three times by mail, or same day. I mean, you'll see the variation. And we believe that those seats that were flipped by using those duplicates and triplicates, that they were ineligible. Those people are sitting in those seats and they're ineligible. What can be done about it? Well, I don't know that they can be brought back, but the Attorney General Bondi needs to look at this, because what California did is they defrauded the whole country, because the people sitting in Congress make decisions for the whole country. And it's our opinion that every Attorney General of every state that cares about this should be filing legal action against California Secretary of State and demanding to know what they did. We filed a writ of mandate in 2024 to try to prevent them from doing that in the 2024 election. And, of course, they refused to answer our questions, and because we filed a writ against the Secretary of State and the L.A. County registrar voters, because so much of it happened there. But they both are sort of pointing fingers at each other. L.A. County said, it's not our fault. We sent all the stuff up to Secretary of State. They did this. Secretary of State said, it's not our fault. That happened in L.A. County. So right now our legal team is looking at filing a federal lawsuit. But we think every attorney general should be looking at this, because, again, we think that's criminal. That defrauded the rest of the country to add 43,000 plus after the fact. And so this is why we decided to write the proposal, as Ruth said earlier. We have gone to every length possible on behalf of the citizens of California. And in fact, the Ninth Circuit gave the EIPCA standing for our constitutional challenge in 2021, and we got executive standing, meaning they recognize Election Integrity Project California as officially able to represent the voters of California. And so on behalf of the voters of California, we continue to challenge the election system in California, which includes an incredibly corrupt system of mismanaging the voter rolls. But this is why we now went to Congress. Californians no longer have the ability to choose who will represent them. All of the processes Ruth laid out and the mismanagement of the statewide voter rolls and the interaction between the L.A. County, which is, by the way, the largest county in the country and is, in fact, larger than all but five states. When L.A. County does something like that, it impacts the whole country and determines who will sit in Congress. So we are really excited in September 24, Ruth and I and another one of our board members, Dennis, who's in the D.C. area, we brought the proposal to 20 legislators, but especially to Congressman Stiles and the committee for writing voter legislation. We brought all that to them. And on our website, you'll see a very long box at the very top, EIPCA and AFF. AFF is Advocates for Faith and Freedom. They're the law firm that we worked with and have worked with since 2021. But we worked with them to put this proposal together, and they actually wrote the legal memo that is the first part of the proposal. I think it's 11 or 12 pages. But the legal memo lays out for Congress that they do, in fact, have the authority to pass federal election integrity legislation for the whole country. In fact, they've already done it. The National Voter Registration Act, that was federal law. Every state had to comply with it. And the Help America Vote Act, same thing. And in fact, way back in our history, in the very early days, the state could make up their own date and time for when they would run their federal elections. And sometimes it takes 6 months before they knew who the new president was. So the very first federal legislation that Congress passed was to make this first Tuesday of the fourth year of November, first Tuesday of November every 4 years would be a federal election. And so so we know they have the authority to do that, and that's what's in the proposal. But what we really wanted people to see, and Aaron, if you happen to be on the link, you'll see when you click on that box, there are a number of links in that box. One is the proposal itself, and the other is the appendix. We cited over 101 BIPCA research, findings, reports, letters to the Department of Justice, all of the actions we've taken to prove that California's system is corrupt and easily manipulated because of the many entry points of corruption. And so we want people to go there and read it for themselves. Look at what the report's saying. Look at the letter we sent to Department of Justice saying in 2020, saying vote count is unreliable. It should be decertified immediately before the 2020 election. And, of course, we wouldn't work. So I think in a nutshell, that's the biggest thing. We want to leave room for questions. But I am so proud of Californians. You know, Californians, you know, really have gotten a raw deal over the last 15 years that Ruth and I have worked with the Election Integrity Project California. You know, the propaganda that Californians are just so stupid, they voted to destroy themselves, is nothing but propaganda. You know, that citizens of California stepped up every year that we were going to observe an election, and take our training, which is 4 to 5 hours, and observe and document for what became 2 months, is amazing that they kept getting up and kept documenting for us. So that's why we have such depth and breadth of document and evidence. And in fact, we have documented the election process in 43 out of 58 counties. That's a massive amount of work for a gigantic state. No other state has this kind of evidence. It's because California kept fighting back. Some of the most amazing patriots are in the state of California. Many have had to flee the state, but even so, they support us through donations in the other states and working in their new states to try to alert people about the possibility of bad law that will create an election system in their state, like what California created. So that's what we have so far, and that's what we're doing, Aaron, and let me leave the rest to questions. What else would you like to know, and what can we tell your audience?
Well, how about this? Let's take our break just slightly early, a whole 40 seconds.
Okay.
That's early for me. And then we can come back with that. I did link this memo. I plugged it on the page, dropped it on the page that we're on, so all the links are there. And your website, of course, and all of that for people to review. And I hope they will. It's February 8th, 2026, in case we re-air this at some later time. And you can find it at wethepeopleradio.us.
They did a bad, bad thing. They did a bad, bad thing. They did a bad, bad thing. They did a bad, bad thing.
You ever loved someone so much you thought your little heart was gonna...
Who's to say I can't do everything? Well, I can try. And as I roll along, I begin to find things aren't always just what they seem. I wanna turn the whole thing upside down. I'll find the things they say just can't be found. I'll share this love I'll find with everyone. We'll see.
guess except for the whole love part, you could use that one too. ditch that part or sub something in. Oh, I'm sure AI could do that for us. Okay, so I'm always channeling the opposition in the back of my mind, which is probably why I'll never truly be happy. but I can hear them saying, oh, there's never been any evidence of voter fraud.
Right.
Right? I mean, you've heard it a billion times, I'm sure.
Yeah, right. And we always send them to the website and say it's right there. If you're willing to read it, the live links are right there.
Right. But if it's against the law to do that, then, and I'm not asking you this because you have the perfect answer, but, I mean, just, then why hasn't any of it officially come to light? Why isn't anyone being prosecuted? Yada, yada, yada. But what do you tell them?
Well,
see if our answers are the same.
Yeah. The fact is, those who are in positions of power and authority, many in both parties, they don't want to see the changes because that's how they keep their seats.
Right.
And the uniparty, we have those in one party who are fighting back, but not all of them in that party are fighting back. And so we're nonpartisan, and that's why neither party likes us. We started in the beginning and said it doesn't matter who's cheating. The citizens have the right to choose, and no matter what party you are, we're going to go after the person who is cheating or manipulating. And so neither party likes us, and that's why we are the best-kept secret. It's very tough to get media attention on what we do, and when we do, it doesn't pick up and go. But you know what? I think we are now at a point in history where so many people in so many states are now being impacted by these bad laws that Ruth laid out for you, that they can no longer say it's just California. They'd like to say it's all those Californians who moved to our state, they're doing it. And we say, oh, sure, like they have that much power. Who makes the rules? It's the legislators. And we used to meet every couple of weeks with people from across the state, Jay DeLancey out in North Carolina with Voter Integrity Project, and Ruth and I with Election Integrity Project. We would be on the a call with people from the other states and laying out for them the issues that we documented and encouraging them to look at the laws in their state. And if they don't see them, make sure they don't let them come in. And if they see them, they should press to have them removed. So it is the laws that create the system, not the citizens fleeing tyranny. They don't have that kind of power. It's the laws in each state, and it's the responsibility of citizens in each state, whether they've been there all their lives or they're new to a state, to be part of ensuring integrity in that process of their state. But when the states can't choose, then it's the job of Congress to act and ensure that every state functions as a republic.
Yeah. It's worth noting that, I mean, elected representatives at the state or federal level are not electing themselves. So we see a lot of bad choices going on. I mean, there were many, many people in California who voted for Prop 50 because they believed that it was going to send a message to Donald Trump and stop fascism and all sorts of other nuttiness. But
Aaron, I don't believe they did, because in the same way...
Oh, they did. I spoke with several thousand of them, actually.
Well, those ones did. But the thing we're concerned about, it goes back even to 2021, Gavin Newsom recall. We knew the number of people, because in our research of the voter rolls and the research of what was coming out, people were voting yes to recall him, and yet in the remaking of ballots, they were changing it to no. And I can't help but wonder how many people voted no to Prop 8, and in the remaking of the ballots, it was changed to yes. There were definitely those who, exactly what you said, they were going to stick it to Donald Trump. But look at how many people voted for Donald Trump in the state of California. Do we think they all voted yes to remove?
No, but I mean, there's many of them I've spoken with, because I'm inquisitive, and so when someone, calls and wants to complain about Gavin Newsom, I always ask, you know, hey, did you sign the recall petition, you know, back when? And, oh yeah, I did. I said, hey, I don't care how you voted, but did you vote when it was on the ballot? Oh, no, I didn't bother. They were just going to cheat. There's no point. And it's like, oh, my God, you're the problem. I mean, there's a lot of that. I think there's more than we would like to. I'm not going to say that that's the answer, but that is a big part of our problem, people abdicating their responsibility to stay engaged with the process. I mean, you're not advocating people just sit at home and hope that it magically solves itself.
Right. No, you're
well,
right
one of the
that.
Points that we make in our articles is that a lot of these policies that have been enacted are actually voter suppression. Because they create that kind of feeling in people, because they tip the scales, and what it's doing is encouraging more people to just sit it out because why bother? And so our message has always been, no, you still have to vote. We can still outvote the fraud if you really get up and do it for now. But it's a growing problem of people just saying, you know, my vote doesn't count, and that is not what you want anybody to believe, right?
Yeah.
So we've given this comprehensive thing, you know, as you saw, it's pretty big, and there's a lot of pieces to it, and we want to make the point that if you just enact one or two of those changes, that's helpful, but it's not going to fill all the holes. Only if we re-secure that election system so that none of this manipulation can get in, that's when we have a secure election system, and then people will feel better about voting. And so we want people to say, okay, yes, the SAVE Act is great, but it's only two of the 17 pieces to what really needs to be done. And we need the public to understand what we're proposing and why, which is why we're saying please go to the website, please read these articles, because in all 50 states now, the people, the enlightened people, need to start slowly putting pressure. I don't want to say slowly, I want to say right now.
Yeah, right.
Start putting pressure on their own Congress representatives in both the Senate and the House to say, hey, we've had enough of these wishy-washy elections that nobody believes in anymore, and you need to make these changes, because this is a very scary thing for Congress, and it's going to take a lot of courage for people to get out and really support these changes. And they will support them if they have the wind beneath their wings, which should be their constituents, saying, do it, we'll love you for it. So it's really important that people understand what we're proposing, why we're proposing it, and then take that next step to, on a weekly basis, just call into your congressperson's office or write them an email, a constituent email, and say, you know, I want to remind you, this bill is there, let's go for it, let's get it all done. If we don't do that, then, you know, the Congress is still not going to have the courage to take that kind of move.
Yeah, well, my guess is it won't fly through, you know, in the Senate, but is there a state, just out of curiosity, is there a state that is kind of like a, I don't know, maybe this is a bridge too far, but a shining example of good voter laws and practices? Is there anybody who's doing great?
There's not any state that's not using some of these laws anymore, but there are many states who are fighting back. Arizona is one of them. The state legislators, and you know what? It's because so many Californians moved here and got involved. And they hate Californians, but thank God we all moved here, because I now run the company from here. I had to move here when my mom had a massive heart attack, and I moved here to help care for her. But many of the Make America Great Again type candidates ran for office here and won. And all last year and this year again, they have put forward many solid, good laws that would get rid of a lot of this garbage. But we have a very corrupt Attorney General and a very corrupt Secretary of State, who Secretary of State just blocks everything. So,
and the governor.
And the governor, right.
Yeah, he's vetoed all those laws.
Right. And so the thing is that's good is every state where the legislators in that state are trying to pass good laws, that's hope for the nation. And citizens in those states should be pushing hard to get this federal legislation passed, both of them, the SAVE Act and the MEGA Act. And states where they're just starting to wake up that maybe we should fight back. Like even in Maine, some of the Northeast are starting to realize, oh my goodness, maybe we went too far. you know, but it's going to be a battle because, you know, the people who were woke, the people who hate America, they have been organized and been fighting back, fighting us for a long time. And what we say to everyone is this: this is the time to truly stand and do the right thing, press for federal legislation that would protect and restore the republic. Because right now, in states like California, California is not functioning like a republic. The republic was designed on the basis of citizen self-governance. We the people choose. And so that mechanism by which we use to choose has to be safe, secure, integrity-based. You've got to be able to verify. I mean, it's just, it can't be manipulated. Because when it is manipulated, like what happened in California through bad state and federal law, then citizens go to the polls and vote, but they're not truly voting for very much. And those, some of them who don't vote anymore, that's why they've given up. Mm-hmm. But when that happens, California is not functioning as a republic any longer. It's more like a socialist oligarchy. And so that's the responsibility of Congress to take action and correct the bad laws through federal law. And that's what we're trying to do in California and all states where the laws have become so bad at the state level that Congress must act to restore the republic and a Republican form of government, not Republican the party, but what our founders put in place for us.
Yeah, because it is pretty crazy. I mean, for the life of me, I cannot figure out what people were thinking with the top two, you know, they often call jungle primary, but top two on the ballot instead of, you know, the top vote getter on the Republican side and the top vote getter on the Democrat side. I don't think there were enough people in third party, you know, in the third party advocacy to make it mean anything. I think it was a way for really the Democratic Party to make sure that they had the top two, and ultimately in the general election, the Republicans had zero to vote for. I don't know. I wasn't watching it real close.
You know, back in the day, I was part of the Tea Party movement, and we were really pushing back. But what we learned is at that time in California history, Republicans just trusted Republicans and Republican voters. So it was Abe Maldonado was a Republican who carried the top two primary, and so everyone voted for it because it was a Republican. Now, at that time, I was still living in L.A. County, and the company was formed in California, and so I used to go to the L.A. County Registrar's monthly meetings for, you know, all organizations. There would be 100 people who would go, and maybe 10 of us would actually be Republicans. But I remember being at one of those after the top two passed, and they were so excited. They were patting each other on the back that we did it, we got them to carry it. And that's how I know what happened with that. They got a Republican to carry it. It was their idea. They developed that in L.A. County, got a Republican to carry it, and the Republicans just said, oh, it must be good. So that's when we weren't self-governing. We were just sort of following party line. And as a result of the Tea Party, I think a lot of people have woken up over the years. That's how we got involved with looking at elections, was through the Tea Party. Yep. So I think now the focus is really turning back to citizen self-governing, and really every voter has to take responsibility for themselves to look at the issue. And that's our hope with our proposal, is giving it to every voter, Democrat or Republican, doesn't matter to us. Look at the facts. There they are.
Well, it is kind of interesting that, and the other thing that isn't always considered is, you know, you hear quite a bit, oh, well, President Trump just needs to do whatever, whatever. And it's like, you do realize that, A, the next guy comes in and potentially just erases that. So it's really not a durable solution. And the other part is, what if, okay, that would work well for us right now, but switch the administration. Is that still working for us? I mean, I think we have to be, we have to take like a longer, you know what I mean? Like a longer view of how these things will impact us, like the top two, you know?
Right. You know, and that's the MEGA Act, they didn't include that. And so EIPCA is going to press them to amend the MEGA Act and add that in. And as we put these articles out, we encourage people to take action. It's not just reading the articles and learning, but we're asking people to take action across the nation to contact their legislators, and there will be one when we do the top two. We'll be asking people to contact their legislators and ask them to amend it and add that in. We've got to end the top two primary. It is part of our proposal.
Yeah.
It's just MEGA didn't include that one.
Well, it ensures that the other part of your voters have options.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's too much to ask, but it is out here now with the gavel coming down on Prop 50 for the 2026 election. We're looking at, you know, what, 48 Democratic congressional members and 4 Republicans likely as the final outcome.
Yeah,
And it's unconstitutional when you look at the map, how many people voted for President Trump.
Well,
and they only have 4 representatives, really?
Yeah, it's kind of, I know there's going to be a lot more to that as we go forward, but for the time being, and the worst thing that could happen is people just throw the towel in and decide that they're not going to play anymore. I mean, that isn't how we fix it. Ladies, we're into the last 30 seconds, so we need to tell you thank you and that we will do this again some more. Hope you will send us information, and we will continue to post it for you. And Election Integrity Project has been really leading the way, and I hope people will go do some reading. And I found a special song for you girls, and I'm sure it's the one they play about you while you're not paying attention. It's their secret song for you. So we will chat with you later. You've been listening to We the People. You can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us.